The headlines: Iran's president says the Israeli regime is by no means a friend of regional nations and that it must be prevented from intruding into the region. Palestinian Foreign Ministry urges the International Criminal Court to investigate Israeli crimes in response to a spiral of deadly violence in the West Bank. Four people are killed and 10 others injured in a mass shooting at a hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma, as gun violence claims more lives across the U.S. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says extreme caution is needed against all Israeli acts in order to prevent the Zionist regime from intruding into the region. Speaking over the phone with Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, Raisi said Israel is by no means a friend of regional nations. He said the oppression Israel has inflicted on the Palestinian people is unprecedented in history. He also talked about Tehran-Yerevan ties and hailed their cooperation in different areas, including energy and transit. President Raisi said the Islamic Republic supports the progress in peace talks between Armenia and Azerbaijan over their border dispute. The Armenian Prime Minister also called for the expansion of Tehran-Yerevan relations. Nikol Pashinyan said a joint economic commission has helped facilitate and accelerate bilateral trade. The Israeli regime is stepping up its deadly violence across the West Bank. Just hours ago, another Palestinian became the latest victim of Israeli gunfire. The deadly confrontation happened between regime troops and Palestinians at Veisha camp in the town of Bethlehem. It came right on the heels of an Israeli raid on the town of Ya'abad near Jenin to blow up the house of Fazia Hamarsha. He was a Palestinian man who was shot dead after killing five Israelis in an operation near Tel Aviv back in March while preparing to demolish his house in Ya'abad. Israeli military forces fatally shot a young Palestinian and injured six others. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has called on the International Criminal Court to break its silence over the Israeli crimes, and Hamas is urging all Palestinian people to unite against the occupiers. Also on Wednesday, Israeli forces shot dead a Palestinian woman near the city of Al-Khalil, alleging she was preparing for a knife attack. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says Israeli forces attack, arrest, and kill Palestinians on a daily basis, using security as their excuse.
We have to say that Israeli forces continue to raid Palestinian areas on a daily basis. These raids and operations, of course, would anger the Palestinians and would lead to Palestinians facing the Israeli forces and fighting with them. As what happened this morning in the refugee camp of Adhesha, Israeli troops raided Adhesha refugee camp in order to arrest Palestinians accused by the Israeli military for being wanted for security reasons. Israeli forces shot dead Ayman Mhassen. He was shot in the chest, and then when he was transferred to Beit Lahem Hospital, immediately he was declared as he dead. We have to mention that Ayman Mhassen was a former Palestinian prisoner. He spent years in Israeli jail, and then he's a martyr now.
People in Gaza have protested to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails, especially administrative detainees. Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. Asher Shannon has more in this report.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
UK-based pro-Palestine direct action group Palestine Action has intensified its targeted campaign against notorious Israeli arms manufacturer Elbit Systems. The group has successfully hampered the firm's activities with weekly occupations of their factory buildings. Robert Carter reports from the scene of the latest action.
Pro-Palestine campaigners once again took the fight to the gates of Israeli arms manufacturer Elbit Systems, with another direct action protest targeting the firm's London headquarters. This is the seventh time the group has hit the site in May alone, while close to 12 anti-Elbit operations have been conducted across the country in that time.
Four activists, two of whom were Palestinians, completely blocked off the front entrance of the building after covering it nearly entirely in the iconic red paint, meant to symbolize the blood of Palestinians killed by Israeli regime forces. Following the action, police took all of the activists into police custody.
While reporting on the London action, news broke of yet another strike, this time a raid on an Elbit business partner in Scotland. Thales, which manufactures military drones and other weaponry, has worked alongside the Elbit Systems on past drone schemes. One of the activists explained why the group's activities have intensified in recent weeks.
The reason we've been stepping up our actions is because of the horrible news coming out of Palestine. We've seen Elbit drones flying over Gaza. We've seen Elbit drones flying over Al-Aqsa in Al-Quds. You know, these, we must respond to the increases in settler violence. These outbursts of colonial violence cannot remain unanswered. I'm very happy to report that all four of our recent activists who took on Elbit in London have been released. They're all out and happy and safe, and they're all unanimous in saying they would do it again. There's no better feeling than taking on Israel's military apparatus on your own.
As violence in Palestine mounts, the role of Britain's arms trade has come under increasing condemnation. Palestine Action have made clear their direct action won't stop until the UK-backed oppression of Palestine ends. Robert Carter, London.
Welcome back. No end to gun violence in the US. Now police say five people, including a gunman, are dead in a mass shooting on a hospital campus in Tulsa, Oklahoma. At least 10 people were also wounded in the incident, a Tulsa police official said. The victims included hospital employees and patients. Local officials say the shooter apparently died of a self-inflicted wound. Police are trying to determine the man's identity, saying he was aged between 35 and 40. The shooter's motive is still unknown. Police say he carried a rifle and a handgun. The new incident took place only days after a mass shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, which claimed 22 lives, including the attacker. The people of Denmark have voted yes in a referendum held to decide whether the country should join the European Union's common defense policy. The final results show almost 67% of Danes were in favor of their country becoming a part of the EU's common security and defense policy. Around 33% of voters opposed the decision. Denmark is the only EU member not bound by the bloc's common defense and security policy. The referendum signaled the latest policy shift among Nordic countries as more European states seek to deepen defense ties in response to the war in Ukraine. Sweden and Finland have applied for NATO membership, whereas Germany has decided to spend more than $100 billion to modernize its army. While Russia has not revealed its casualty figures for some time, the Ukrainian government is admitting huge losses in the east of the country. Johnny Miller reports.
Russia is currently pounding the Donbass with its overwhelming air and artillery superiority. On the ground, Ukrainian soldiers post videos on social media from underneath the barrage. With each passing day, the odds of these soldiers surviving dwindles, as President Zelensky today made the staggering statement that between 60 and 100 Ukrainian soldiers are dying every day, with another 500 wounded.
As this conflict began, many voices around the world said that it was NATO's plan to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. Well, many Ukrainian units now are refusing to head into the hellstorm that is currently the Donbass, and as they say, to face certain death.
In an underreported phenomenon, in the last week I have seen more than half a dozen videos posted by Ukrainian units in which they declare they are refusing to fight. They say they are not being adequately trained or equipped, that their commanders are not going with them, and that they are being used as cannon fodder. This is the 115th Brigade. After refusing to fight, they were arrested for desertion. I have also seen videos of women in Ukraine protesting the predicament of their sons and husbands.
The Ukrainian armed forces can largely be categorized into three separate groups. First of all, you have the far-right, in some cases neo-Nazi militias, who do have some influence over Ukrainian politics, but are also ideologically driven to fight the Russians. You then have the well-trained Ukrainian soldiers, often trained in NATO countries, who are also, judging by various social media posts, bolstered by foreign mercenaries, in particular some former special forces fighters of NATO countries. They, of course, are highly trained and highly motivated. Then you have the National Guard, who are largely conscripted from the reserves. They are not very well trained, they haven't had fight experience, and they're far less motivated to fight. It's from these groups that these posted videos are coming from.
Yeah. Eduard Basurin, the deputy commander of the Donetsk People's Republic, who are fighting alongside the Russians.
The situation in Ukraine was being developed for one thing, to destabilize the Russian Federation. They are interested in this destabilization lasting for as long as possible, hoping that the citizens of Russian Federation will get tired. That's why they are interested in fighting to the last Ukrainian. So I have pity for the people in Ukraine. They are being eliminated, and I don't see the end of it. It's a big tragedy.
An apartment in Odessa. Military summons are plastered all over it. And here, another summons. In order to make up for their huge losses, Ukraine is increasingly calling up its reserves. And since the beginning of Russia's invasion, men of military age are not allowed to leave the country. While Ukrainian government propaganda relentlessly claims that the fight for Donbass is worth it, many Ukrainians would rather live in peace, even if it means territorial concessions. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
French unions took to the streets around the country as new data shows that France's economy has reached record new lows. France's penchant for protesting also seems to be dwindling despite the widespread economic hardship. Rami Mazari reports from Paris.
For the first time since the presidential vote, France's unions marched nationwide, as the nation's public services will likely be under major attack for the next 5 years. Polls show President Emmanuel Macron will likely have almost as strong a grip over parliament as in his first term.
Unions repeatedly warned that the coronavirus was being instrumentalized to accelerate the long-standing neoliberal goal of defunding public services. Now they face a re-elected Macron who could be more powerful and confrontational than ever.
Macron's policies have meant the ending of so many social services and not replacing public servants who retire. This means those still working are doing double the amount of work as before, and that has led to burnout, illness, and even suicide attempts. If Macron would come talk to us, he would see that we are not being treated fairly, but I doubt he will.
New data shows the French economy has stagnated to the brink of a recession. Inflation in the Eurozone just hit its highest annual level since the currency began in 1999. That combination spells stagflation, something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy, and it comes after a decade of austerity measures which were allegedly supposed to strengthen the Eurozone.
The inflation index point has not been changed in a decade for civil servants, so our salaries have been constantly falling, and this was before this year's record increase in inflation. On top of this, they are asking us to work longer for the same pay, so our hourly wage is being reduced and we have less time away from work to be with our family and friends.
Despite the new lows in economic data, unions were not able to draw as many to march as in years past. Since the coronavirus restrictions began to be lifted last fall, many have noted that French protests are occurring less often and are smaller in size. It could be that, after a decade of mostly failed labor efforts, workers simply can't afford to miss work anymore. Or many have given up trying to influence Brussels or the French government. Or many French could be too scared to protest given what happened to the Yellow Vests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we spoke about Imam Khomeini's arrest in 1963 by the notorious organization SAVAK. As you know, we try to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saqafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. If you remember, it was said that the news of Imam Khomeini's arrest resonated like a bomb throughout the country, and people from all walks of life poured to the streets of cities to protest the Pahlavi regime's act. But the regime, instead of listening to the national demand, massacred thousands of people in various cities and towns. This time, we are going to touch upon the events after the arrest of Imam Khomeini. You also heard that the people of Qom would gather around the house of Imam Khomeini to reduce the psychological pressure of the Imam's family, yet they would be soothed by the patient family of the beloved leader. Today we are going to continue the events in the aftermath of Imam Khomeini's arrest. Stay tuned, please. After the arrest of Imam Khomeini on June 4, 1963, he was taken directly to the officers' barracks in Tehran and then to Qasr prison. The imam was then transferred to another prison in a barracks after 19 days. However, he stayed there only one day as he was jailed at a solitary confinement. During the beloved leader's imprisonment, the regime agents very much tried to break his morale through interrogation, but to no avail, as the imam would keep silent. During Imam Khomeini's imprisonment in Tehran, a few scholars like his elder brother, Ayatollah Pasandide, were allowed to visit him, but the Savak agents didn't let the imam's wife to visit him. On the third day of the imam's stay in prison, it became clear that he wouldn't eat the food of the prison due to temperamental reasons, so his family was allowed to prepare the food and sent it to him. The imam's venerated wife says, "We hadn't heard of the imam in the first days, and I was very worried. After being informed of his prison, we would take him food. I mean, we would prepare the food at my mother's house and Mashhadi Ali would take it to Ashratabad prison." After nearly 1 month, Imam Khomeini was transferred from this prison to the house of a man called Abbas Nejati. The event caused zeal and hustle among the people as they swarmed around the imam's residence to visit him. Ms. Saghafi relates as follows. A few days after the imam's stay at Mr. Nejati's home, the conditions of Dawoodiya neighborhood and Shemiran Street quite changed. There were police agents on horse. They had stood there with their special gesture while people were sitting at sidewalks and the cars moving on the street were a means of propaganda against the system of oppression. The government noticed how badly the conditions were going on, thus it decided to transfer the imam to another place. One of the emulators of the imam, called Mr. Rouhani, overtook the responsibility of imam's stay and the imam stayed at his home for 2 months, while under the Savak house arrest. A house was also rented for us near there in Qaitariye. We started a new life and spent the winter over there without any heater. The imam came to us after 2 months. It was a cold winter and it would snow very much. We were in shortage of quilts and mattresses. During those months, no one would think that the person who was the symbol of a struggle against the Shah would face so much hardship. The Savak's control was so tight on Imam Khomeini and his family as they were scared of his influence among people. But after a while, they decided to release the imam under certain conditions. The regime was insisting on returning the imam to Qom by the Savak agents to imply that he had reconciled with the regime and retreated from his stance. But Imam Khomeini didn't accept the decision and put some of his belongings on the seat beside him and didn't let any of the regime agents to accompany him. Lady Saghafi continues, "The regime agents came and said to Imam, 'You are free.' As the Imam saw that the Savak head had come, he said, 'If I am supposed to go to Qom with you, I'd better stay here. I prefer the imprisonment here to the freedom while your agents accompany me.' He had realized that they wanted to enter Qom beside him to show to the people that there were no differences anymore and there were friends with the Imam. Imam Khomeini was not content even with this. When they saw the imam's insistence, they accepted that nobody would accompany the imam in the car. To prevent anyone from sitting by him in the car, the imam told us, "Give me that samovar and rug. I want to take them to Qom." The rug and samovar were taken to Qom with the imam. Perhaps the imam wanted to break their palm. The course that the Savak agents chose for taking the imam to Qom would remind of an attempt on his life. The imam's wife relates, "The agents followed the imam's car by another car." The imam said, "They were taking me through alleys. First I thought that they might finish off me, but as we turned to Hazrat Abdul Azim Road, I realized that they had taken me from outside the city so that the people couldn't see me." On the Tehran-Qom road too, one of the Savak agents pointed to the narrow route leading to the Salt Lake. I thought that they would kill me. I asked the imam later, "How did you feel at that moment? Did you fear?" He answered, "By God, I didn't fear even at the time that they were taking me to the prison. I said, okay, they will take and kill." Imam Khomeini's return to Qom turned his house to the center of popular gatherings and politico-religious debates. Ms. Saghafi says, "The imam went to Qom and I returned whatever I had borrowed to the owners and set out for Qom the day after. I entered the house from where the imam had been abducted. I mean Mustafa's house, which was opposite our house. The house was full of people. The political issues in this house were deeper than before, as we had more experiences. Once religious issues were raised, but today the government had raised the issues which would confront the religion and were followed by the uprising of the ulama. Today it was the imam who would tell them what to do, what not to do."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Iranian foreign minister, while in Davos, Switzerland, appearing at the World Economic Forum, made Iran's case when it came to the JCPOA. First, he said that an agreement on the Iran deal is possible if the U.S. makes a realistic decision. Is the U.S. ready to make a realistic decision? And what does a realistic decision even mean? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we'll try to find out what that means. We will take a look at why the U.S. continues a maximum pressure policy and things like sanctions to have incurred on Iran, including ship confiscations, and yet it does not want to deem the deal to be dead. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter joins us from Bethlehem, New York. Also joining us, political analyst Said Mostafa Hoshesh, who joins us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'm going to first start with you, Mostafa Khoshesh, because I'd like to understand what Iran's foreign minister meant when he said, quote, now we have reached a point during the negotiations that if the American side makes a realistic decision, an agreement would be within reach. I'm curious as to what you think he means by that realistic decision referral.
Hello, and thanks for having me. Well, this has been the case for the past 2-3 months. Before the Russians raised concerns about the future of the deal, some problems started because the Americans started buyer's remorse on a couple of issues. The number one issue was the red sanctions list. I'll explain about it later if necessary. And then the removal of the IRGC from the foreign terrorist organizations list. And also, a third issue pertains to one specific category of guarantees. Iran has requested guarantees, four types of guarantees: nuclear guarantees, economic guarantees, legal guarantees, and political guarantees. And now there has remained some one or two of these issues. People are well acquainted with the kind of guarantee Iran has requested from the Congress. Iran has said that either the Congress should endorse any future deal, or the Speaker of the Senate or the Speaker of the House should issue some kind of statement in support of the deal. And all of it is because the U.S. has violated the deal. It has proved to be irresponsible. If a deal comes up, common sense rules for receiving as many guarantees as possible from the United States, that's one of the main necessary issues that Europeans have requested European companies, as well as Asian companies. One of the high-level diplomats in Tehran was telling me some 2-3 months ago that if Iran expects us to return for investment in Iran, we do not agree with whatever guarantee the U.S. gives unless one specific type of guarantee, and that's economic guarantee to you and to us, that states that the U.S. would respect our contract. Investment contracts are long, like 10, 20 years. So for the entire duration and lifetime of that contract, no matter what happens to the JCPOA and if the U.S. stays under the JCPOA or not, once it is revived. Okay. So this has been requested by foreign companies, and before dealing with the IRGC issue, these sanctions and guarantees issues are highly important to economic interests that Iran sure. should receive from any kind of revival of the JCPOA. And one more sentence. What Amir Abdullahian said, the U.S. should take a realistic look, means that instead of going for, media hype and, using cries about IRGC's removal from the FTO list, they know that before we come to that point, specific point, they need to resolve issues with regard to the sanctions and guarantees. They are hiding that. They have tried to derail public attention to the IRGC issue. That means they are just playing. They are not working for real solution of the problem and in order to have a deal.
Do you agree with that, the fact that the U.S. is doing that, Scott Ritter, that there are, well, let me use the words of the foreign minister, Abdullahian, before I get an answer from you. Quote, the U.S. blacklisting of IRGC is only a secondary issue, nation's top priority. In fact, IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups, a secondary issue has been magnified by the pro-Israeli lobby. and our main priority is the interest of the Iranian nation. That's what the foreign minister has said in Davos. What do you think?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, that the issue of the sanctioning of the IRGC is a purely political move by the United States. It has no practical impact on Iran's nuclear program, on the JCPOA as a whole. It was done under pressure from members of Congress who are themselves under pressure from the the pro-Israeli lobby here in the United States and the Israeli government itself. But I'll take a step back. I remember reading about the deliberations of the Iranian parliament in the lead up to the finalizing the JCPOA in July of 2015. And there's some very, very difficult discussions. The Iranians knew up front that the United States was not a trustworthy partner because it's there in black and white. They said so. And the Iranians were looking for assurances at that time that the U.S. could be trusted to stay the course. And it turns out that the Iranians were right, that the U.S. is not a trustworthy partner. And it's not just Trump that betrayed the agreement. In April of 2015, prior to the JCPOA being finalized, Barack Obama, the hero of the JCPOA, gave an interview to National Public Radio where he said, issues like the sunset clauses are not carved in stone, meaning that once the agreement's made, the United States will come back and reconsider whether or not it wants to allow these sunset clauses to expire, or if we're going to create a whole host of issues to control Iran. The United States has no intention of allowing Iran to possess a nuclear enrichment capability that the JCPOA says it's allowed to. And Joe Biden was the vice president of Obama. He has inherited that policy. And Joe Biden today, I will just state right up front, has no intention of allowing the JCPOA to reach maturity, that whatever agreement is reached now is a short-term agreement to buy time to force or compel the Iranians to backtrack some of their commitments or some of their advances that they've made in the nuclear arena while the United States works with Europe and others to find a new tactic to constrain Iran. A renewed JCPOA isn't the end of the crisis. It's just the beginning of a new crisis.
What makes you think that, though?
Because that's what the Biden administration's policy is. Listen to them. They're straight up front. They are not going to let the sunset clauses expire. They're just not.
Okay.
They will impose. One of the reasons why they don't want to have ironclad prohibition against the resumption of sanctions is that once they bring the Iranian nuclear program under the control of the JCPOA, they want to retain the ability to impose new sanctions if necessary to put pressure on Iran to make compromises and the rights that it has successfully negotiated for itself under the JCPOA. So ask any Iranian negotiator. They'll tell you that's the case.
Well, Seymour Sabah-Hosheshma, obviously the Iranian side is very much well-versed in tactics that the U.S. has used. And at least I'm not there at the negotiating table, but I'm guessing that it's a very seasoned, well-informed team that has the experience of the previous team that was there. And what Scott Ritter says there, I'm sure they are also speculating that or using that in their calculations. So how do you go about going into the revival if you have that many doubts involved?
Well, that's exactly the point why Iranians are asking for guarantees that they would receive the merits under the deal. That's why they do not agree to go beyond the JCPOA. They have already stressed in response to the Biden administration's repeated demands for going to JCPOA over Iran's missile power, over Iran's regional power, and God knows the list continues, and God knows when and where they want to put an end to this long list of Iran's power components that they want to harness, that they want to contain. You know, they don't have any kind of problem with Iran's nuclear power. They got a problem with Iran's power as a regional power. That's what they want. They are not for a conflict resolution in there. Iran and the U.S. have, or its allies, they have signed 6 agreements over Afghanistan, Iraq, 3 atomic accords with the Europeans, the Troika of Europe, from 2001 to 2005, altogether 5 agreements. And the 6th one with the JCPOA. In all of them, Americans admit that Iran has been completely loyal to its undertakings. Why? Because Iran wanted a conflict resolution and believed that the other side is there for a conflict resolution. But the Americans had only one major undertaking, removing the sanctions, and they never did that because they are not there for conflict resolution. They are there for their containment strategy that includes using carrot and stick policy in order to slow down Iran's progress in various areas of power, in the nuclear industry, in the missile power, regional power, drone power, and so on and so forth, then stop Iran's growth and then start a rollback in order to push back Iran's growth. Now, Iranians know it pretty well, but they want to show their good intentions, but they are no fools. They have the lessons received under the administration of President Rouhani. They know Americans are not responsible party, and they should receive guarantees. That's exactly one of the major points under discussion, under debate. But Americans do not want to discuss it. They want to just do some kind of media, show, and claim that the two sides are in trouble over only one single issue, while this has never been the case since February.
Well, we're still looking at officials from Iran who are making a case for this, Scott Ritter, and also the Americans who don't want this to be dead because they're saying that it's still the best viable option, whether you're talking about the U.S. Secretary of State or you're talking about the special envoy, Robert Malley. Now, Iran's Foreign Minister Abdollahian, and another quote from him that I want to get your reaction from, is that Iran must avail themselves of the full economic advantages of the JCPOA. The talks have been going on for quite some time. Is Iran looking to see a cycle be completed in the midst of the time that has elapsed from the beginning until now? And perhaps there's a test that's going on, so that it could then draw a conclusion as to now is the right time to finalize the talks? Are we looking at a certain scenario of that kind?
Look, I think if Iran could get the guarantees from the United States, although I would caveat it, and I'm sure the Iranians believe the same, because they don't trust America, nor do they have a reason to trust America. But America will not comply with any agreement they make with Iran. That's absolutely certain. Even if Iran gets all they want, statements from, read the Constitution. A statement from the Speaker of the House is meaningless. A statement from the Senate Majority Leader is meaningless. The Constitution is the only thing that matters, and the only way to make an Iranian agreement with the United States on the JCPOA, one that the United States must adhere to, is for the Senate of the United States to ratify a treaty, a formal treaty. Anything less than that makes this an executive decision made by a president that, while it may have the force of law while the president's in power, if he's replaced by another president who disagrees, like Donald Trump, it will renege it. And this is what's going to happen, because the United States is not going to give up the capability to snap back inspections in the future. The United States is trading off the promise of immediate economic gain for Iran, short-term economic gain, so that Iran will sign, will agree to the terms that the U.S. has put out there. The U.S. will come back to the JCPOA, and everything will be fine until we get to the issues of the expiration of the sunset clauses. Then the United States will start to raise new issues, and when Iran refuses to depart, the U.S. is going to impose sanctions all over again. That's a reality.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at another issue that we need to talk about, because it's always there.
May I add something in reference
to this
battery there? Yeah. Scott, that's why Iranians actually worked out a long list of guarantees. From these 4 types of guarantees, 3 of them I mean, economic guarantees, legal guarantees, and political guarantees, they all depend on the U.S. goodwill in compliance with, you know, its endorsement. And we do know that the United States, as you said, would not act in compliance and in goodwill. That's why the first type of guarantees that they call essential guarantees or nuclear guarantees, you know, they were the first that Iran worked and ensured to have, because it depends on Tehran, not on the U.S. compliance, but it's the only type of guarantee that Iran can rely on because it stays under Iran's power. What is it? When you keep your highly advanced centrifuge machines in store, sealed under the IAEA, but inside Iranian territory, under Iranian control, without dismantling. Number two, if you keep your materials, nuclear materials, intact in Iran, store them here. Number three, if you keep your know-how, nuclear know-how that you have earned intact, and without any pause in continuing these studies, then you can ensure that if the U.S. starts defying the nuclear deal, if it is revived ever, then you don't lose anything. You will not sustain damage or losses.
Can we get Scott Ritter to react to that?
That's a deterrent factor. That's a deterrent factor against, one more sentence, that's a deterrent factor against the United States defiance, because that means if you just go astray, if you defy the accord and your undertakings, we start doing the same thing, the 60% enrichment, and maybe we will start 90% enrichment.
There you go. Okay, Scott Ritter, so he's got a valid point there. What would the U.S. do? Would it risk that?
Again, I don't trust anything. If I were the Iranians, I wouldn't trust any agreement that the United States... Look, Iran's not stupid. They've been betrayed before, and I understand the intent of these nuclear guarantees. You know, but Joe Biden is dealing with domestic American politics as much as he's dealing with, you know, international security or, you know, geopolitical issues. And Biden is going to, if he's going to reenter the JCPOA, it's only going to be because he gets some sort of political boost here at home. No matter what the United States agrees to, Iran needs to understand that the policy of the United States mirrors the policy of Israel, and that Iran cannot be allowed to have a functioning, modern, capable nuclear enrichment capability, and that they are going to do whatever they can to ensure that in the long term, Iran doesn't get this. Now, they may make some compromises up front for political reasons to rejoin the JCPOA. Israel right now is saying that, at least some people are quoted in the Jerusalem Post, saying that a bad JCPOA is better than no JCPOA right now, because it does retard Iran's progress in the nuclear enrichment field. So I think there's a lot of political impetus to get a short-term political bounce from finalizing the JCPOA. But in the long term, the United States and Israel, and maybe many of the European partners of the U.S., will be looking for ways to undermine Iran's nuclear enrichment capability going forward.
Well, since you mentioned Israel, I got to get this out of the way. Quick answer, if you can, on this, said Mostafa Hoshesh. Many analysts and headlines, I'm sure, that you're familiar with have said, was the assassination in Iran another Israeli effort to sabotage the JCPOA? Because previous killings, according to one entry, actually took place at times in Washington and Tehran, actually appeared to be on the cusp of a diplomatic breakthrough, perhaps. Do you agree with that? Is that what may have happened?
First of all, Scott, we are on the same page. That's right. Just for the record, we do not trust America. We do know that the United States has never been loyal to its undertakings. They would not stay loyal to this deal. Some might ask why then we are in the talks, because we have paid our dues in cash upfront under President Rouhani. We've never received anything. 2 years, 3 years maximum is left from the JCPOA's 10-year-long period. And we are there to see if we could earn cash in, I mean, what we've been promised. If possible, good. If not, then we don't, you know, rely on that as our main foreign policy pivot. But in response to your question, I'm not from those guys who believe that the Israelis are acting so separately against their strategic partner and want to sabotage or torpedo the deal. On the contrary, I believe that when they assassinated Iranian IRGC colonel Martir Khodai, and just 48 hours later, it's the prime minister of the Zionist regime, again, the same regime that has done the assassination, that declares officially that the U.S. will not withdraw the IRGC from the FTO list. That has a lot of meaning. That in a matter of 24 hours, there is a Senate hearing there. Menendez, the senator, and Rob Malley, the U.S. envoy on Iran, they confirmed the decision. They approved, and I mean, they endorse what Naftali Bennett has said. That means this kind of decision by the United States has been a green light to the Israelis to do the assassination. Exactly. That is to say, the Biden administration has okayed Israeli assassination efforts. They've given a green light to go ahead with this policy in order to pressure Tehran, to remind Tehran that we have more options to harm you. Definitely, there will be a response to that. There will be retaliation. There will be escalations. The end, we believe, would not be beneficial to the Israelis and Americans.
Okay.
But American policy is also to be blamed. They are also responsible for this assassination, despite the fact that they leaked it to New York Times and tried through that article to send this message to Iran that we are clean of this assassination that has been done by the Israelis. It's not been our decision. We didn't want it. Israelis have informed us we are not responsible. But Iran would not take that. We believe Americans are also guilty. They have blood of Colonel Khodai on their hands as well.
All right, very well. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. And let me thank, that was Mustafa Khoshchesh there, political analyst. Thank you. And former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, thank you. Spoke to us from Bethlehem, New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Tavoy and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Rabbana
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Al Musavi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته and welcome to IRIB English Radio and you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at the supplications of Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn Zayn al-Abidin found in الصحيفة السجادية. We are up to supplication number 8, verse number 1, where the Imam seeks refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from number of vices. And we got up to him saying, وَقِلَّةُ الْقَنَاعَ and less and lack of contentment. And there are obvious reasons to why the Imam salamullah alayhi asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give him more contentment rather than less. Because we said it is linked to Iman. And those who are not content, it means those who will fall into the sin and the vice of hirs and tama', stinginess and neediness. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says in a hadith, حُرْمَ الْحَرِيصُ خَصْلَتَيْنِ ولزمته خصلتان. He who is not content or he who is needy, he will lose two things and two things will stick to him. حرم القناعة. He will be deprived of contentment. فافتقد الراحة. Thus, he will never have a peace of mind. So when we talk about a peace of mind in this life, we're constantly wanting to have more and more and more. We're constantly worried. We are constantly stressed. Even though we have wealth, we have health, we have families, we have a roof over our head, but you see that we are not content. That's why, because we fell into the trap of hirs, of that neediness, that selfishness, that greed, because we want to have more. So the Imam says, you have that, you will get this. You will be deprived of contentment and you'll be deprived of your raha, your relaxation. Let us take a short break and then we will continue right after.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana,
welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Imam Saliq alayhi salam, he continues in the hadith that we began before the break, and he says, وَحُرِمَ الرِّضَى, and that person will be deprived of being pleased with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And being unpleased with Allah, it means what? He says, فَافْتَقَدَ الْيَقِينَ. He will lose certainty with Allah or in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is a very risky thing to have. So when I am not pleased with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah gives me health and wealth and whatever, even though it might, in my calculations, in my opinion, in my mindset, it seems to be too little and I'm not happy with it, that means I'm not pleased with Allah. I'm saying, oh Allah, why are you giving me less? I need more. You know, I'm poor, I have debts, I have this and I have that. I complain about Allah. That actually causes me to have less yaqeen, to have less certainty in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'm saying, oh Allah, you're not good. You can't provide for your servants. You're not giving them what they want. You are not taking care of them. And I've heard this from a lot of people. From those who even assume, or at least they say they are religious and in tune unto Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When they are faced with a problem and they don't seem to be content with their lifestyle, they start to complain. They're not pleased with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And thus they fall into the less of certainty. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, يَا أَيُّتُهَا النَّفْسُ الْمُطْمَئِنَّةِ, or you soul who is content, return to your Lord. ارجع إلى ربك راضية مرضية. That you are pleased and your Lord is pleased with you. So you need to have that contentment to be راضي with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and with whatever Allah is giving you. And you can see that clearly in Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the battlefield of Karbala, when every time he loses a family member or he loses a companion, he says, رضا بقضائك يا رب. I am content. I am pleased with whatever you declare, whatever you decree, O Lord. So he reached that stage of certainty that whatever happens, whatever problem falls into him, is because of Allah and he's happy with it. Let us take a short break and then we will continue right after.